once you get them to contact you, you've got to realize lead generating is a complex process. The quality of the lead is first important. The conversion process is second important. The average unit of sale you get them to convert to is third important. What you do with them after they become a sale the first time and turning them into an ongoing customer is fourth important. And each one of them requires critical strategic focus and understanding, and I could do probably 5 hours on any one of those categories.
Okay.
You can ask me a question, or we can save it for another program.
I'm kind of thinking we ought to do another series on that.
I think we could do a whole series, a separate program on any of these things could spawn an 8 or 10 tape or longer series or a live event, and I'm delighted if the interest in the part of the subscribers is such to do such programming, Marty.
Well, we call it the Wizard's Edge, and there are a lot of different ways to get the edge, and we'll just continue exploiting your vast experience. I know, as I have delved into your knowledge base, that you have to have borrowed from someone in many ways because there's so much there. Did you pick people's minds? I learned
a process years ago of subordinating myself and trying to learn what other people have learned more effectively than I, the knowledge that has driven people. I've become a great interviewer, a.k.a. interrogator, at getting right to the core of the driving, what I'll call the core principles, the organizing principles that have distinguished people and given them their success, even if they don't know what it is. And so what I do is I read biographies. I read summary. What I try to do is I try to read people's, first of all, I try to read people's books on principles. Then I try to get biographies or meet people or research people to learn what somebody's life was and the experiences they encountered to cause them to summarize these principles. Then I try to meet successful people, and I ask them very pointed questions. I ask them questions about what their biggest success strategy is, what influenced them the most, what one thing they would tell me to do if they never saw me again, what the biggest lesson they learned was, how they learned it, what they think the key success factor in their business or in their philosophy is. And I've learned to interview people and ask a lot of questions. I observe all kinds of businesses and industries outside of what I do, and I look at them to see what the driving force is, what the marketing essence, what the philosophy behind it is, what the distributive process is, and I try to ask myself, how can I utilize or improve upon that or combine and incorporate those essences into other things I'm doing for myself and my client? I read all the time, and I read with an interpretive or an extrapolator's mindset. We've talked about that on previous issues. I always am interested. I subordinate my own self. I don't want to tell you how great I am. I want to learn what you know that's great, even if you don't know you know something great. So I'm always questioning and asking very pointed and probing and interested questions on very specific natures that reveal to me the core operating nuances of your business, your industry, your mind. That's pretty much it.
You use the word mastermind a lot. Is this involved?
To me, I think the greatest opportunity you've got is to plug into the leverage of if you can in the course of any week interact and plug in to 20 people who have on average 20 years experience in 20 different industries, and they have accidentally developed expertise they don't even know they have, and you can find from them every month or every week you can learn what 20 people learned in 20 years. That's like giving yourself 400. Is it 400 or is it? Yeah, it's 400 years worth of leverage every week.
Ooh.
And masterminding is going to people who've already encountered what you haven't yet, who have seen life in a different perspective, who've dealt with different versions of the questions, the problems, the opportunities, and have overcome them, and plugging into what they've done to save time, effort, emotion, capital, and frustration. And I think the only way you can do it, I don't care how bright you are, you may have 160 IQ and be the brightest man or woman in captivity, but if you can plug into 1,000 different people who've already dealt with your issue and learn how they've done with, wow, it's such an advantage, Marty.
Okay. Jay, normally at the end of The Wizard's Edge, we talk about 10 ideas in 10 minutes. You've generated so many ideas. We have about 6 minutes left. Can you talk about one overall maybe strategy or point instead of your normal 10 ideas?
I can. I think the biggest strategy that I was impacted on and I'd like to share with others is how much is possible, not how much is impossible. How much you deserve and you owe yourself, not how little life has to give you. How much infinite potential and riches life currently has to offer, not how limited everything is, how little factors like the economy or competition really have to do with your success, how adversity and obstacles are opportunities. And I think it's a mindset. And a mindset's got to be one of curiosity, of discovery, of possibility, of all kinds of things. I've spent a lot of time counseling and experiencing all kinds of things. I've spent a fortune on therapists and everything else, and I can tell you what I learned because it might help a lot of people, and that is that most people are obsessed with an end product. They want to be rich. They want to be handsome. They want to have a big house on the hill. They want to have a Mercedes automobile. They want to have $1 million in the bank. Most people are so obsessed with the product, they can't spawn the process to get there. But the truth of the matter is, if you ever get it, it's normally anticlimactic. That isn't going to give you the joy. The real joy is in the process. Every day, every communication, every discovery, every experiment, every interaction, every contribution, every realization, every growth that you do can be viewed as such a wonderful richness. If you take that kind of attitude, every day, every minute is wonderful to live, and you got to get the most out of it. And you want to get the most out of it because you realize you have the capacity, that you are not limited or restricted by what your competitors do. You're not restricted by the hours because the hours have nothing to do with your achievement. You can get so much more leverage and results out of the people who you employ, out of the dollars, out of the time, out of the customers, out of the communications, out of the advertisements, out of the sales efforts, out of the vendors, out of everybody. I think you've got to resign yourself to the fact that you owe it to yourself not to be average or sub-average. You owe it to yourself not to go through your life in your business and be content with mediocrity when less effort, far less risk, and far more joy can give you far greater outcome, and you can get so much more out of it. And I think that the biggest philosophical tome I would like to impart at the end of this program is don't deny or restrict yourself that which you and your effort and your emotion and your intellect and your intelligence deserves.
Is there a technology to facilitate that happening?
I think it comes about. I'm a little bit benevolently insidious, if that makes sense. The purpose of plugging the subscribers into this subscription service is to ever so delicately infiltrate their mind and in the process change their mindset to a possibility-based instead of an impossibility-based, from one of abundance instead of scarcity, from one of discovery instead of one of constraint, from one of interest instead of one of trying to be interesting, from one of contribution instead of one of self-serving. And I think I'm accomplishing it, but I think it grows upon you, and I think we're achieving our goal through every installment and every issue and every subject and every philosophical point that we embrace.
Okay, how about a one-sentence philosophy of the J. Abraham approach to life and living?
I love humanity. I embrace and joyously celebrate everybody. I want other people to be more enriched than I, and I love being part of the process, and my ego is subordinate to that. And it's about everybody else. It's not about me.
Jay Abraham with the Wizard's Edge. Jay, great talking to you. We keep learning more. We'll look forward to next month.
Thank you, Marty.
Marketing genius Jay Abraham on the Wizard's Edge. That's all for this month. Thanks for listening. Marty Stacey saying bye-bye. Welcome once again to the Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. This is Marty Stacey, the communications director for The Edge. Jay, what part of your strategies do people typically have, your clients have the most difficult practicing?
It depends on the kind of clients. If they're clients that come to me, Marty, for passive advice that they're going to execute themselves, it's execution. If they're clients that come to me for active, hands-on, ongoing work, it's valuing my input long enough to keep the program going. Because what happens is, I'll take both scenarios. If it's somebody who listens to the advice and wants to take it for themselves, they usually mis-execute in the beginning. And my analogy to it would be, let's say we broached upon this once, Marty, you exercise. But let's say the first time you decide to exercise, you've never exercised diligently or continuously or appropriately before, the first time you go to do it, if you go to do it on your own, even if somebody explains it to you, the odds of you doing it correctly, both procedure-wise and diligently and appropriately, are very low. And so the first couple times you do it, you don't get the result you want. You get a frustration. You get sore. You don't see very much immediate response. You feel really klutzy, and you don't want to continue it. That's what happens normally when people take on the responsibility of doing this themselves, because they're more execution-oriented than they are philosophically oriented. The problem with most people is they try to do it technically instead of as a philosophy. You got to get it into a philosophy. Once you get it into a philosophy, everything else will work. But most people try to go right to the technique and not to the mindset. When I'm helping people on an ongoing basis, the problem is they pay me a lot of money. When it works initially, they think it's so easy, they don't want to continue paying me, but they haven't really learned the mindset, and they take it over themselves, and they normally mis-execute, and they immediately go back to what they were doing. So it all boils down to the same thing, getting the philosophy ingrained in your mind.
I think you had mentioned once before about how some people would go out and make actually quite large amounts of money and then stop.
Yeah, what happens is they've justified the investment. It worked, but they go back to the status quo. Whenever something doesn't work right, we go back to what we used to do because that's our comfort. That's our security. It's the biggest challenge is constantly challenging yourself, constantly stretching yourself, constantly. I mean, again, I don't know what you or anyone listening to this segment of The Edge has ever done that they've gained mastery and proficiency at, but I assure you, whatever it is, if you look back and you inventory and review the actions and the process you engaged in, you had to confront, grapple with, and overcome an incredible level of fear, of inertia. You had to keep stretching yourself because there were stages in that proficiency garnering process where you weren't good, where you suffered fear, awkwardness, discontent, discomfort, queasiness, apprehension, and you had to go through the tunnel of darkness to the light at the end, and you have to do the same with this.
Okay, with that in mind, let's tackle something that I have in front of me. You have had a summary of, I don't know how many of hundreds of thousands of dollars of consultation. Describe kind of the synopsis that we're looking at right now.
Well, what happens is this, Marty. You had asked me on a previous segment if I would consent to allow you to take actual consultations, programs, private advisory sessions I'd done with people that paid me, used to be $2,000 when I first started, then it's $3,000 that I've recorded and gotten the rights to from clients in exchange for other services I've performed for them, and whether I would be willing to let you sort of summarize and I would reconstruct and sort of enumerate the key issues in true real-life advisory sessions I'd done. You thought that by doing that, and we took 5 or 10 example situations that spanned a very broad spectrum of situations, it would help the listeners see real-world execution, application, implementation, and tangible examples that they could see clear how to use these philosophies, how to use these techniques, how to use these mindsets in a real-life way. And I agreed. I took transcripts of the best 75 illustrative consultations I've performed in the last couple of years. I do hundreds of them, but these were really illustratively very great at embodying lots of different examples. We sent them out to a lot of people who painstakingly went through them trying to distill them down to the key essence so that we can review them really quickly for our listeners, for our subscribers, and try to embody a bunch of different examples quickly so they can get a broad spectrum of possibilities. I would mention before we go through this that I think the key opportunity here is looking at how we apply the same mindset in very specifically unique applications for all kinds of different businesses or industries so you can extrapolate and say, wow, that application makes eminently good sense in my situation. Or you could say, I see how he did it there, and I see the bridge of how I could apply a direct correlation to my situation. The arrangement that I made with the client. The client paid me thousands of dollars. The average session's about 3 hours, and again, I did them over a period of time, so probably you're looking at each session was probably $8,000 or $9,000 worth of expense a client did with me. What we've done is summarize them, give the client a pseudonym so it wouldn't breach a confidence, and we got the rights from the client to use it so that we wouldn't breach confidences. Go ahead.
I think you've positioned us to partake of these. These are very, very interesting. Let's talk about this. Scott, he has a pretty large dental practice, but he has a lot of trouble attracting new patients. So far he's used, and I'm guessing, Jay, that these are fairly common, yellow pages. He hasn't tracked responses for that, however. Referrals. His office people are not real facile at that. He's used some advertising agents, and he's felt that that's largely been a waste of money. There's probably a lot of ideas on how to solve this. What would you do?
Well, what I did was the following. First of all, I gave him a philosophy that he should use the most powerful marketing formulas to start with, and he shouldn't be obsessed with spending large sums of money to attract new customers. Instead, he should build an intimate rapport with his customers already in his database and use them as his leverage, even clients or patients who are no longer active. So what I gave him in a nutshell was the first thing I said he should do is take the names of old inactive people he hasn't had done a lot of services for in recent years and experiment with different approaches to each one to see which approach would resonate the most. So I said break them into three or four segments. Let's say you have 500 or 1,000 old inactive patients, customers, clients, however you want to look at them. Break them into three or four different segments. Let's say you had 1,000, so you'd have 300 or 250 name segments. Send each segment a different personalized letter from Scott. Each letter would approach the issue on a different focal thrust from a different hot button. Analyze which letters worked best. Again, test. So when you find which letter evokes the maximum response, and response is the maximum number of old inactive patients coming back to you or referring new people, you would then take that winning letter and send it to the other two or three segments that didn't originally receive them. Okay. Then I gave them about four possible approaches or styles to experiment with. Number one was try one letter that addressed possible problems, i.e., you haven't come to me for a lot of reasons. Perhaps one is you have had financial problems. Or number two, perhaps you don't feel like I've cared. Or number three, perhaps you don't feel like I did well by you the last time you were here. Or perhaps you had a lot of pain and it was uncomfortable for you, or you felt I was not responsive or sensitive to an issue or a problem. And then deal with that and offer, first of all, that you want to correct it, that if that was the case, it was totally erroneous, it's not the way you feel, maybe you were having a bad day or maybe they were not communicating clearly, but you want to clear the air, rectify the situation, and be responsive to them. That was one suggested letter. Another approach was what I call the assumptive letter. The assumptive letter we never talked about, but it's a very proven winner approach that I've used in probably 500 different applications. It's designed to assume. It's designed to assume a need or a desire or a problem that a finite number of the recipients of the letter have and not asking a question. A lot of people say, do you have this problem? It's taking the assumption. And let's take a very real-life application for this dentist. A letter goes out, and it assumes to the inactive patients, people who haven't been around for a long time or haven't dealt with this dentist for a long time, that they have had problems, that they're noticing either irritation or bleeding or soreness or pain or discomfort or tenderness or sensitivity, and deep down they know that's not a problem that's going to resolve itself. It's a problem that they know in their heart of hearts, if they let it linger longer, will only get worse, and whether they come back to Scott or they end up having to go to a different dentist, it'll be a real situation that'll cause them grief, and he doesn't want that to continue for whatever reason they haven't come back, whether it's fear, whether it's absent-mindedness, whether it's other personal problems, whether it's financial, whether it's a way that he has dealt with them. He knows they have problems, and he knows they have to deal with those problems, and he's extending an offer to take care of it now and clear the slate. An assumptive letter is very powerful because it resonates to that segment of the recipients who really have that problem. So that's one approach I suggested.
Okay.
Another approach is a different form of the assumption. It's an approach that says, I know you've been thinking seriously about calling my office and scheduling an appointment, but you've probably been preoccupied with other issues in your life and put it off. And this letter is my way of helping you take action now because it's so important to you, not to me. So it's like a connective letter.
Mm-hmm.
And the last letter was from the assistant or the receptionist basically saying, Scott, Dr. whatever Scott's last name is, Dr. Smith asked me to write you this letter. He's been thinking about you and worrying about you, and someone was in the office that reminded him of you, and he looked you up in the records and saw that you hadn't been here in an appropriate amount of time, and that worried him. He knows either something is probably wrong, and he wanted me to call and tell you that he's concerned about you, not as a customer, but as a friend. He wondered if something's wrong in your family, if you've been ill, if you know something has changed in your life. He wants you to call our offices, even if you found another dentist. He just wants to make sure you're getting someone to treat you.
Okay.
So there's four different approaches that I suggested they take.
Any idea of what Scott ultimately did? Do you recall? And I know these.
I'm sorry, I don't. These are basic actual responses. But what these were, I have three levels of consultation I do: ongoing, contingent, ongoing fee, and one-shot quick fix problem solving. These were all taken from the latter because those tend to be the biggest issues that I think are most illustrative to the people listening to the Edge. So I'm sorry to tell you, I don't. If he did what I would have recommended, he would have done all four, because no one knows which one will resonate the most to your particular inactive customer base, because I don't know Scott. I don't know if Scott thinks he's the most caring man in captivity, but basically is impersonal and discompassionate and burns people off. I don't know if Scott's so expensive or his collection techniques are heavy-handed and he offends people. I don't know if he's so unresponsive and non-proactive that even though they love him, he doesn't make it easy for them to deal with him. So you got to try all of them, because I don't have enough time in the course of a one-hour or two-hour session to identify the real issues that cause clients and customers not to come back or come back with the frequency they should.
Okay.
These letters are designed to discover and resolve that issue automatically for the client, if that makes sense.
Okay, yeah. I suppose in the case of Scott the dentist, then, in his overall approach to marketing and promotion, you'd emphasize what, caring?
Well, what I did tell him in this case was caring, and integrating caring and empathy into all your materials. What we've learned in a lot of work with professionals is that money is secondary to a sense that people really care about their well-being, and most dentists don't seem to be able to denominate that and integrate that into their communications. Keep in mind, I think we said this on one of the first segments of The Edge, communication and relationship building on a very personal and individually acknowledged basis is probably the key, easy-to-understand secret to success in any mode of marketing. It's the easiest way to demystify it. You make people know that you care. Your foremost and utmost interest is their well-being. You focus everything externally. You communicate clearly and continuously. You acknowledge and respect their situations. You understand and empathize with where they are, and you always, always, always lead them to an intelligent action that serves them better than you.
All right. All right. Let's move to another sample of your clients here. This gentleman, Walt, is an investment broker. He's worked kind of traditionally as an investment broker. Some of his people have done well. Others have stopped using his services. He doesn't really have any unique selling proposition. He's got not much of a background, really, in contacting prospects, and he doesn't really know what to do from here on.
Yeah, I got to make a point, which I think we broached upon on one of our last calls. But I think I got to make it really evident before I go into explaining him, because it's a universal issue that a lot of people have to understand. There are so many people who are proficient in the transactional part of their expertise. This man was a very good, or at least a decent, investment broker. He was a good security salesperson and financial planner type person. But the key element of distinction in your life has got to be how well you market that perception, how well the marketplace appreciates, understands, and values the value of the service and the benefit therein and the result that you render. Most people listening to The Edge and most people I advise are grotesquely inefficient, ineffective, limited in their ability to market. Marketing is what we're trying to help this gentleman do in Walt in his practice. So what I did basically was I tried to explain to him that instead of wasting time and money on cold calling, I wanted to use direct mail to reach your customers and your prospects with a far more personal, individualized message. I said, let's identify what the best category of prospective investors are. And let's do it by renting lists in your specific industry and geographical area to get the most qualified customers. We found out who the most qualified customers were. They were men and women, as I recall, 45 to 65, who were of higher income means, professionals, business owners, higher level managers, who had assets and investment resources that they wanted to grow and build. And I cannot remember the area of investment he specialized in, but I said, well, why go just to anybody? Why don't you go to people who've already evidenced they respect the value of advice and that they have investments that they are making to protect, preserve, and build? And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, why don't you go to people who already are paying for advice, people who buy the Wall Street Journal, people who subscribe to Barron's, people who subscribe to financial newsletters, people who have purchased investment or financial-type books by mail in your community. So you know those people probably have 10 times the probability of being good prospects and 10 times the probability of respecting your expertise, because when someone favors an investment broker, a financial services expert, what they're really buying is not the transactional skills. They're buying the advisory skills, whether that's explained or not. Does that make sense to you, Marty?
Yeah.
Anybody can execute the transaction. Charles Schwab can do that.
Okay.
And do it for less. If you're going to pay a premium, which is what you do when you go to an investment advisor or broker, you're paying him and her for their skill, for their knowledge, for their expertise, for their understanding, for their research, for their recommendations, for their advice, for their expertise.
And this broker, Walt, needs to come to grips with that and the way he approaches the whole situation.
Right. He's got to do it two ways. He's got to do it by the communication he makes, but he's also got to do it by the people he communicates with. I mean, there's a great adage in marketing that the media is probably the first critical ingredient in successful marketing. The message is second. The proposition is third. And so I'll tell you a funny story, which is appropriate. And I don't know if I ever told it on the edge, but I'll tell it again. There was a man I used to do training programs with, and he was one of the foremost advertising experts in America. And he asked a question of a group one time, if I were going to give you the opportunity of owning a restaurant in any locale you wanted, and you got one advantage over everybody else in that restaurant, what would the advantage you would want or desire be? And he went around the room and asked people what advantage they wanted over everybody else. Some people said, I'd like to own the only McDonald's franchise in my city. Somebody said, I want the only fat-free chicken restaurant. Somebody said, I want the only restaurant that it's located on the corner of five highways converging. And he said, fine, you can have all that. Finally, everyone had all the advantages they wanted. And he said, now that you've had all yours, let me tell you one advantage that I want. Did I already tell the story ever?
No.
He said, I want a starving audience, a starving crowd. So what you want to do when you're trying to market is you don't want to dispatch your message to a non-responsive audience. All the factors I could give you, if I put you in touch with 25,000 people and you know that every one of those people, A, has money they're investing, B, has a respect for expertise, C, subscribes to the investment newsletters because they're looking for information that'll give them an edge, D, takes action on that, that's about 100 times more valuable than saying, here's a list of people in your community who might be prospects or suspects. Does that make sense?
A lot of sense.
So, and it translates to everybody listening to the edge. You don't want to waste, I mean, the greatest message disseminated to the wrong market is a waste. The worst message disseminated to the right market will make you a profit. So if you want to hedge yourself and get leverage on everything you do, the first thing you want to do is have the right media, the right market you're communicating with. Mm-hmm. So in the case of this investment broker, I said, let's go to a reference directory. There's a publication called the SRDS, the Standard Rate and Data Service Directory. It's published by SRDS Publishing, Standard Rate and Data Service Publishing. I think it's in Skokie, Illinois. I don't know what the area code or the phone number is. But they publish a massive directory every month And it's a very, it's like $300 a year to subscribe to it, but any good business reference library would have a recent copy of it. And it lists 30 or 40,000 different mailing lists you can rent by distinction, by category. If you're trying to reach a target audience, you are always better rifling than you are shotgunning. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Right, right.
Most people don't begin. They say, okay, I'm going to run an ad in the newspaper looking for very specialized people. Well, in a lot of distinctions, you can find the people you want by either looking up the category or looking up something similar. If you know what their hobby is, if you know what kind of car they would drive, if you know what kind of area they would live in, if you know what kind of products they would own, if you know what kind of publications they would subscribe to, if you know anything about their interest, you can normally identify them a number of different ways, and you can rent mailing lists of them, and that gives you about 10 times higher probability of being successful than just going in shotgun mode to the outside market. So I recommended that to this gentleman.
Okay. All right.
Then I suggested to him that he use personal letters or offer seminars that made customers feel important and educated and gave them information and knowledge they didn't already have. Information and knowledge they could mentally validate that it was valuable to their investment objectives and would give them empowerment. Okay?
All right.
I suggest that he incorporate in these letters benefit-oriented, fact-filled messages. The message should, first of all, explain his expertise and how he got it, and then show why that expertise had self-serving value to the recipient of the letter.
Mm-hmm.
He should make them a very specific offer of information or advisory service or a consultation or something that would bring to them self-serving advantage. He should show them what they could expect to get as far as a benefit from being exposed to him, either in a live seminar, on the phone, in a private consultation, or if they came to his office on a free session. Then he should tell them why they should take action now, i.e. if they're investing money and their money is in motion, and he's got information that could give them more yield or less risk by taking a different strategy, they owe it to themselves to learn it now and to give that consideration against what they're doing. So he would give them a reason why they should respond now and then direct them to how and why to act.
Okay.
Then I told them to try to get endorsements, that as important as it was to identify these audiences, if he could get some man or woman or organization that these people trusted who'd already invested an enormous amount of time, years, money, effort, actions, dealing with these people, either an association, a business, somebody who was in some activity that they dealt with that respected them, and that man or woman or organization would sign a letter and endorse this person, it would give enormously greater advantage and believability and credibility to the offer and would thus eliminate or reduce or dramatically lower the resistance or the skepticism or the uncertainty factor and tremendously raise the interest and the excitement and the believability factor, which would then manifest itself in a higher number of people calling or coming or responding or taking advantage of the offer.
Mm-hmm.
I told him to take away the risk and make sure whatever offer he made, it was information-oriented, educationally-based, valuable, had a promise, but had no risk. In other words, they had nothing to lose. They could send for free information. They could come to a seminar for free. They could take advantage of a free advisory session or consultation. The only thing that would happen is they would be enhanced. They would be benefited. They would be improved by doing it. They would never be compromised, or they'd never be obligated, or never be forced or compelled or required to make any investment commitment or pay any service fees or anything else.
It sounds to me like you're actually are indeed offering free advice. I mean, this is not just window dressing here.
I am, but see, free advice is only desirable if you believe it has value to you. So you got to create the value first before you. If I say, Marty, I want to give you a free consultation on how to be a greater interviewer. Well, that only is going to have value if I say the man doing this consultation has interviewed the presidents of 5 countries. He's been published in 108 different magazines. He has a regular show on PBS. He is regularly paid $35,000 just to interview somebody, and he's boiled down the key elements that makes his interviewing style superior and more listenable and probingly reveal more elements from people. And he would like to share with you for 90 minutes the secrets that he thinks has made him renowned as the preeminent interviewer in the world. And he'd like to do that without risk or without obligation to show you how much better your interviewing skills could be and to introduce you to a new process he has developed. And that's pretty exciting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a... I'm ready.
Yeah, but you see what I mean? But you've got to create the expertise and the desirability and the value to you.
Okay.
First, before you could desire it. It's a very critical distinction.
It seems to me the kind of advertising that I have seen along this line generally does not do that.
Well, that's good because most people don't understand. Most people think it's all about them. It has nothing to do with you, the advertiser, or you, the marketer. It has everything to do with the recipient, the customer, prospect, and it has everything to do with them seeing and then wanting to seize the personal self-serving advantage that you offer them. If you don't clearly denominate and communicate and telegraph and illustrate and prove what, why, and that what you offer is such an advantage and that what you offer will produce such an incredible outcome and that what you offer will produce an incredible improvement in their ability to conduct whatever it is they conduct, either in their mainstay business, in their profession, in their hobbies, in their avocation, they won't desire it. And it's right. When I explain it, it makes eminently good sense, but most people don't stop and think. They just commit effort, time, emotion, money, resources to feeble actions that are all self-serving on their part. It's like, as I said, in another edge. The marketplace could care about what's in it for you. They don't care if you're desperate. They don't care. They don't care if you got the greatest thing next to sliced bread, unless and until you show them why that's great for them, not for you. They don't care about you.
Okay.
If they don't care about you, you shouldn't care about you either. You should care about what they care about, which is themselves. That's where you get rich.
Okay. Okay, I wanted a couple quick tips on this investment broker. Let's go to the next one.
Well, I think that the goal that I gave him was twofold. Was predominantly was trying to offer very invaluable and informative training seminars for new investors or for existing investors that have revealed to them actions, strategies, insights, distinctions, awarenesses they didn't already see and that no one else had told them. And I said you could do it by a number of different ways. You could do it yourself, or you could synthesize a collection of experts who have knowledge about the industry and bring them together and share the cost. In other words, most everybody wants to do it themselves, the Jay Abraham session. However, if I could find five other people that had five other takes on the same subject and were not competitive and could put them together and get them to add their expertise and their segment of insight, I could do two things. I could make the proposition even more valuable for the potential attendee, my prospective customer or client. More importantly, I could get the other participants to absorb and pay almost or even more than the cost. In the case of this, I suggest that I think, I'm going back, that they create a multifaceted seminar, and the seminar could be themed something like better ways to improve your investment performance. And they got an accountant, and they got a banker, and they got other people who weren't directly competitive to all pool together to have like a five-expert forum that could give about five times the dimension to it, and that they all pitched in to give a far more unified and dimensional offer to the customer, knowing that all five of them would get different prospects out of the people who attended, but they wouldn't be competitive, they would be complementary. But the neat thing about it is if it costs $5,000 to do, and instead of you bearing $5,000 worth of risk, if you got four other people and you went to them with a turnkey program, you could basically use your ability to turnkey the program concept, your ability to understand it and put together the promotion and the marketing as your, quote, sweat equity, and get the other four to pay all the expenses.
Okay.
You can get your participation for free. Does that make sense?
Yeah, makes good sense. Would you have Walt advertise in the newspaper, do mailers or both or what?
The first thing I would have Walt do would be identify the highest probability prospects, and normally that would be direct mail. In other words, if I said to you, here's your options. Let's say you're going to do an investment seminar. Let's say you lived in Los Angeles, as I do. if your choices were, one, run an ad in the LA Times where you've got to pay what's called a CPM, a cost per thousand, for everybody who reads the newspaper, knowing that only maybe one out of 10,000 readers is a prospect, that doesn't seem efficient. If, on the other hand, you could rent a list of people who subscribed to an investment newsletter, and you knew that 100% of the people getting that letter from you were prospects of a high quality instead of maybe very low-quality suspects like the newspaper,
mm-hmm.
where do you think your better investment of money is? One way, you spend $10,000 for a quarter-page ad in the LA Times knowing that 95% of the people reading it aren't prospects. The other way, if you spent $10,000, that would pay to reach 20,000 people, 100% who were right on the money prospects if you rented the right list.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's just logic. When you understand the options you have, you realize with embarrassment how ineffective most of people's expenses and time commitments have been.
Okay. All right. Next scenario, beer and beverage distribution company. We'll call him Derek. Distributes name brand beer in a small rural area. Recently, he's also taken on fruit juices, soft drinks, and other beverages. Nonetheless, his business is on the downside. He's had to let people go, make some cutbacks. Biggest problem, apparently, is from the brewery that he deals with. They don't pick up any of the advertising tab, so he has to do any local advertising that he wants done. He also has a kind of a tough problem with advertising of competing brands. They seem to be more successful.
You know, this was a very interesting dilemma because the business he was in was a very low-margin business. When you're in a low-margin business, you have to change strategy. Your strategy has to be, how can I build a high loyalty, highly repetitive customer base, or how can I get greater distribution that will pay off on an ongoing basis? You can't denominate your actions on a one-shot basis because there's very little probability you'll make out that way. You've got to look at it over the long haul, and you've got to have a plan in motion that's going to get you a lot of qualified people who have a high probability of repurchasing over and over again in enough times that it really pays off for you.
Okay, expand on that just a little here in this scenario.
Well, okay, I'll tell you what I did with him, but before I'll just say that there's a lot of different strategies. A lot of people are frustrated because they'll do marketing and the marketing doesn't make them a profit. I think we talked about on one of the edges understanding lifetime value and marginal net worth of a customer, didn't we?
Right.
You've got to know that. You've got to understand that there are certain situations where it is not probable you're going to make a massive front-end profit. It is, however, extremely probable if you employ and deploy the right marketing strategy, you're going to produce an incredible residual profit, meaning ongoing repeat transactions from new people coming in as customers. With a situation like Derek's, we had to opt for that kind of an approach. So that being said, let me try to go back and reconstruct what we did for Derek. Okay. I think his problem, as I recall, was his company had the capacity to what they call co-op, and a lot of vendors have the capacity to co-op, but they don't willingly do it because most people who have access to co-op or who could have dissipate it, and both sides get no outcome. In other words, the manufacturers, in this case I think it was the beer company, had co-op monies available, but they were loath to make it available to people like Derek because Derek didn't have a history of using it wisely. And number two, Derek, whenever he would do co-op, didn't see enough outcome that he wasn't real eager in doing it either because he thought it was a waste. So I think the first thing I told him was try to reestablish the communication with your manufacturer or with your your source, in this case the beer company. Show them that your approach, your idea of how to use co-op, and co-op for those people who have never done it or don't understand it, is lots of manufacturers or suppliers have or could be made to have a willingness to cooperate and substantially contribute, underwrite, collaborate, absorb, or endorse almost some part of the cost of advertising, of promotions, of selling processes you engage in, as long as you mention, refer to, or focus them on their product or service, they do it different ways. Some of them will seed the money just to get started with the relationship. Some of them will give you matching funds based on sales you do, a percentage of sales. Like, in other words, they'll match you 50-50 up to 5% of the total sales you do or purchases you make with them. Some of them will be open to nuances if you can show them that it has the capacity to break ground and build you new customers. And with Derek, I think I said the first thing you have to do is develop a better relationship with the beer company. You've got to get them to be receptive to doing things with you that are non-traditional. How do you do that? By showing them that you understand more the function of co-op than anybody else, that you have the willingness to break ground and pilot programs that, if they work, will be tracked, measured, quantified, and so cost-justified that the beer companies can use your research, your piloting efforts, to apply to all kinds of other distributors all over the country. So they shouldn't see it as a dissipation. They should see it as a very astute investment, with you working very hard not only to succeed but to document and codify and structure it so they'll have a method of taking it to other places. By approaching it this way, they see you doing a lot more for them than them doing for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the first thing I said. I said that you got to develop better communications, and they have to see you in better harmony or sync with their objective. They can't see you just being another distributor wanting to misuse their co-op funds, because they won't give them to you that way. Then I said, find risk-free propositions. If you can demonstrate to your distributor that you can increase market share or volume with very low risk, they're usually willing to provide additional help, because if you can increase your market share 3% and you can show them how it works and that it's a formula, they can take that formula to 1,000 other distributors. So they'll have more motivation than you will to see and help you be successful. The key in marketing, when you're trying to get cooperation from distributors or suppliers or vendors, is you've got to be able to identify and show the vendor how it's going to be so much more valuable to them than to you long term, and how what you do is only perhaps one application. But if you basically get their support and make it work, they can take the resulting mechanisms or methods or process or procedures or programming, and they can reuse it in 100 other applications to grow their business with all their other affiliates. That's the self-serving angle you've got to use. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it's an application of your principle that people want to be led.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And so what you had to do was try to find a unique selling proposition. And I think in this case, Derek had to go to his marketplace and find a way that he could ingratiate himself to retailers selling beer, because there's lots of beer. He had to show them that he could give them better transactional service and give them better prices. So he had to find things he could do for his retailers that his competitors weren't. And I think it differs in each retailer, but I think part of it was basically maybe servicing them more often so they didn't have to stock as much. I think it was giving them greater promotions that would sell product in their store so that they could turn more of the inventory. Trick in life is always, you got to realize, when you are selling any product through distribution, there's a non-verbalized message that's being telegraphed. It's one of two things. Both distributors are basically saying to the retailers or the people who distribute their products or services, take on my line instead of my competitors because I need the money. They're not saying because it'll give you a greater value. The few people who understand marketing go to people who can take on distributive products, and they say, I want you to distribute my products over my competitors because I'm going to grow you more business, because I'm going to make you more money, because I'm going to eliminate or reduce your downside, because I'm going to get rid of your headaches. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's
what
I was teaching Derek to do for himself.
Okay. Any other insights here in Derek's problem?
Well, I think the biggest problem that Derek had was that he didn't think he could have anything to offer his retailers, and he didn't think he could have anything to offer his distributors. I showed him how he could offer his distributors test programs that they could take everywhere else, and I showed him that because most people in his business had been relegated to a commodity and they were insensitive, if he was the only person that went to all his retailers and connected with them and said, look, guys, I know that selling beer is a cutthroat business. I know that everybody and their brother is trying to price gouge you. I know that everybody comes here. All I can tell you is that we're committed to growing your business. We're not just trying to get you to buy our products. We're going to do everything we can to sell more products, to keep your cash flowing more, to make every inch of space you give us produce the greatest outcome, to be sensitive to you, to be there, to be supportive. If you have a problem, be there, to commit our own resources, and do whatever it takes. All I can tell you is that we care more about your well-being than anybody else. And if you'll give us a chance, we'll prove it. No one else did that, and they got more people to favor them. And in a high-tonnage business like beer, getting one more section of the shelf or getting one more front-end display or getting one more sign-up in 1,000 locations can move hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars more products. And that's what happened with Derek. I know that he grew his business about 25% by this simple philosophy. It doesn't take a lot. It takes an understanding, Marty, of the factors that are converging to positively or negatively impact the outcome of various events that you're involved in, and then understanding what you have to do to change that to your more favorable advantage.
2 minute summary here before we go to site two. What happens if you get backed into a corner? I mean, you're trying to deal with these people, and they kind of back you into a corner.
Well, if you're backed into a corner, you have a couple of things you can do. First of all, normally the truth will always set you free, and most people are afraid to tell the truth. Whatever the situation is, if you explain to the other side why you're doing something, what you can do to better it, and you come up with a plan or a solution that works better for them than for you, you're never, ever going to be compromised or suffer. And that's what I always tell people to do, is never allow themselves to be caught in a situation where they're compromised. Always extricate themselves by telling the truth and by looking for a way that they can solve the other person's problem. I can tell you a couple of I've had situations where we've done things and people have called and said, you know, we feel violated. We thought we were the only person doing this, and you're doing it someplace else. And we would basically say we didn't mean to. We thought it was a non-duplicative market, but if it causes you a problem, what we'll do is go back to your market and fund the communication that we thought that we want to do something more special, and we'll fund and offer them a better deal or a better advantage. If you always deal with the problem and say, where is the opportunity? What can I do to make a bad situation an advantage for my customer or for my customer's customer? And you look and search and strive to do that, you will never fail.
Jay Abraham, can we go ahead and do a couple more of these? These are, I think, pretty interesting and actually pretty useful.
Yeah, well, sure. And what I'm trying to do for clarification, Marty, is when I try to go into my recollection, and you got to realize I do so many consultations that I got to go back in my memory bank. So when I try to do these, I'm trying to interpret and embellish them in a way that has universal clarification and application and implications and implementation possibilities to the various spectrum of business-based and professional listeners. So I'm trying to span the gamut of ideas on how you can use this, so bear with me because I'm trying to use my full resources to make it easy and clear and understandable to everybody.
We have talked about the, 10,000 businesses you've consulted with. I'm beginning to get an appreciation for the discipline it must take to be able to shift gears to encounter the various forms of business.
It requires a keen, real-world empirical understanding of how a lot of businesses operate, and it requires the ability to focus very tightly, and then it requires the ability to do it again and again. And it's a really interesting process because you've got to be able to be all-encompassing when you're doing it and then subordinate everything else after you've done it and go on to the next one. So it requires an understanding of businesses at such a broad and high and wide spectrum, and it requires not being theoretical. You've got to really understand the realities and the nuances of how real businesses operate.
Mm, okay. All right, we have more of The Edge coming up. Stay with us for marketing genius Jay Abraham on The Wizard's Edge, Side 2. All right, here's another test. chiropractic products. Isaac, who is a physical therapist, developed a new piece of equipment to strengthen the spine and the back muscles. He's selling it for about $600. When you use it, you also learn how to exercise, and he thinks that nobody else offers anything like that. Can you tell him how to break into the market in a big way? Because it seems to me if he doesn't break in a big way, he's going to get lost.
Yeah, but I'll underscore it. I get a lot of people coming to me in a lot of businesses where they're successful, but they develop either a nuance or a spin-off or a byproduct product or service that in their opinion, has enormous application, but it's such a fresh new idea or approach that it's so foreign to their current mode of generating business, they don't know what to do. And I want people in all walks of business to relate to what I'm saying. Isaac was a very successful physical therapist. He was very successful in Southern California. As a byproduct of his physical therapy activity, he created this product as a really great help to people with back problems. However, he didn't know. He knew how to build a massive physical therapy practice. He did not know how to get national distribution or national sales for this product. And this was the key element of the consultation that I did with him. And it should have a lot of universal application because there's probably a ton of people who either have or will have or have had ideas on new products or services that are extensions of what they're doing, but they have far greater implication than just their limited local or regional application, but they don't know what to do to really get the fullest possibility from it or even to take it to a higher level. And some of them require enormous capital infusions if they have to do it themselves. They require selling them to big companies. They require joint ventures and things that that can be foreboding or intimidating. And I think this was the case with Isaac.
What does he do first?
Well, my recommendation to him was pretty straightforward. First thing I said was go to people on a joint venture basis. Go to people who've already got what you don't. In other words, let's say he's developed the product, which he had, but he didn't have the capacity to manufacture it in big quantity. He didn't have the distribution sources with all the kinds of professionals, chiropractors, orthopedic surgeons, other physical therapists all over the country, necessary to make the product really go. And he didn't have the financing necessary to set up a big operation. So I said, what I would do is go to people who have already got the distribution. Show them that you'll prove to them at your expense that the product works and can be sold in a local application if they will give you, before you do it, an agreement that if it produces a minimum level of success, they'll take it over and distribute it through their system on a joint venture or a royalty to you.
Oh, okay.
So the trick is, most people do it wrong. Most people go to people and say, I got an idea, I'll sell it to you. Well, the companies you're trying to sell it to don't know the idea works, so they're being asked to put time, money, evaluation. My recommendation to Isaac was, because he'd already spent like 2 years of his life and maybe $100,000 of his capital perfecting it, but it was going to take another $2 million to get it in either personnel or organization or manufacturing to get it to a national product. And I said, why don't you take the product, because he already had maybe 100 prototype samples made.
Okay.
I said, all you got to do is find somebody who's got the ability to get you your market once you prove it works in a small application.
Mm-hmm.
Get them to give you a contingent agreement that they would do that. They would put their money, their $2 million into it to distribute, to manufacture, to take it on, once and if you could prove in a small test environment that it worked, and show them that on a relative basis you've already put $100,000 in it. You will not ask them to follow through and take it on until you've first proven to them in your city, which was a city in Southern California, that you could make it work in a small environment. And that was a lot easier because you're saying to somebody, only take it on after I've proven it works, as opposed to take it on spec.
What kind of negotiating power do you have for the deal there?
Well, you have a lot more. I mean, it's one thing when it's conjecture-based. When it's already success-proven, you've got about 10 times the clout, don't you think?
Okay.
If I say to you, Marty, I want you to put up money to run this ad for me. I've never tried it before. I hope it works, but you got to risk $10,000. That's not too appealing, is it?
No.
But if I say, Marty, I ran this ad one time and I spent $3,000 and it brought in $25,000. Unfortunately, I spent that money paying off debts. I need to run the ad in a big publication. It's going to cost $50, but extrapolating on my test, that $50 should bring in $100. And $80,000, and the downside is that if it loses more than $3,000, I'll make good on the loss, but I can't really fund the whole thing. Will you put up the risk for half the profit?
Okay.
That's a lot better approach, isn't it?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay, did you generate any other ideas besides your...
Sure, of course. That was the first one.
Okay.
By the way, my marketing strategy and my mental mindset to people is never put all your eggs in one basket. Hedge. At very worst, you'll find one program that works for you and not be disappointed. At best, two or three different pillars will work convergently and concurrently, and they will increase your success level many times because it'll integrate. So what I always recommend and what I believe I recommended to Isaac was, don't just do one thing. Have like a five-pillar strategy. Pillar one is go to people and offer them the chance to do a joint venture in the historic and conventional professional distributive levels. In other words, you go to somebody and say, you can have exclusive to take this into chiropractics, into orthopedics, into physiotherapists, into all kinds of professionals who are in a perfect place to sell the product to their clients or patients as an extension of the therapy they came for. But I said I'd retain, if I were you, the rights to sell it directly to the consumer, but respect the price and never whore or compromise price. And I said if I was doing that, I would create an infomercial. Because infomercials allow you the chance to demonstrate products in application. And I said, if you get someone else to produce it, because they've got the wherewithal and the capital to create it, you could make a deal where you get to buy inventory for them because you can buy it at their cost or at their cost plus a profit, and it's a lot easier. Right now, I think he was looking at $2 million to start it up, but if somebody else sunk the $2 million and you have the right to buy it back from them, all of a sudden, your cost is much, 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 much lower. If you can buy it for them for $50 a piece and it sells for $500 or $800 or whatever this product was, $600, that's a lot better than you having to sink $2 million to be able to do that.
Okay.
So I said, sell them the rights to doing it wholesale or trade, but keep the rights, but the opportunity to buy from them at their cost plus a pre-agreed-upon profit for selling it to their consumer market, and then sell it through infomercials because infomercials give you the highest possibility of reaching the mass audience at the same time cost-effectively, but also demonstrating the product in motion and application.
Okay.
I said, again, build a multi-tiered marketing base. If one tier falls or just does moderate, the rest of it works. In other words, if you only broke even on infomercials, you would be creating market awareness for all the people going to chiropractors or orthopedic surgeons or physical therapists. Does that make sense?
Okay, sure.
I said if you got a $600 product that your cost is $40 or $50 and you have $550 worth of spread, you could afford selling it through some pretty sophisticated programs. You could get people to come to seminars who had back problems. You could get physicians and orthopedic people to come to seminars where you demonstrated it. You could afford to spend a lot of money to get people to come because if they came and they came and bought, particularly people who would resell it to their patients, you'd have an ongoing stream of sales, so you could afford to sink a lot of money in the acquisition of either the customer or the distributive source. Does that make sense?
Okay, sure. I would assume there's some kind of risk there if someone competes at some point in a big way.
I think basically if he was the controlling source, either directly or through licensing other manufacturers, he would want as many people. I mean, if you got a back problem, you're going to go to your chiropractor. If I've got a back problem, I'm going to go to my chiropractor or my orthopedic surgeon or my whatever. So if I'm going to two different ones, you are hedged a lot more if both of them are selling your product than just one.
Okay.
If I run the product on television direct to the consumers, a finite number of people are going to buy direct, but more people are going to just be exposed to it and it'll be credible when they have it introduced to them by their physician or their chiropractor.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. Yeah.
I explained to him how he had to basically, I said, if you're trying to get the professionals to use it, don't be afraid to invest in a free sample because if I'm an orthopedic surgeon or a chiropractor and I see in the course of a week 100 people have back problems, and you can convince me that by using and offering this product, their customers will be benefited. But in the process, from a business context, they'll make an extra, let's say, $350 or $400 every time they sell one. Then if you get 10 people started using it and they sell 10 people a month, that's 100 transactions at wholesale for you. You have so much to gain by getting people started that don't make it hard or difficult for them to use your product. A lot of people won't either send free samples or let people use their product because they don't understand that every 10 people you send one to, if 5 start using your product and they have the capacity to sell 10 a month, you're investing in a pipeline, in a distributive network. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Some way of looking at the whole transaction.
Okay.
I think I told them also, you got to reinvest. the key in the startup stages, the embryonic stages of getting any product or service established, is you've got more at stake to get the market established than any of the people you're asking to take it on. If you go to a chiropractor or an orthopedic surgeon, it's one of maybe 20 things they could sell or offer or services. It's all important to you, so you've got more at stake to get this product to be preeminent in their minds and preeminent in the customer's minds than possible. So I said, make sure if it's successful, you allocate a recurring and a continuous portion of the sales or the profits to market two ways, to the public so they'll be aware, and to help the professionals market and get more of them to start, because unless you reinvest in building, you're going to be static and you're going to plateau. And that's, most people plateau because they don't reinvest. When they start something, they mount an incredible action to get it started, then they stop and they don't help people keep selling it. They think their job is done. In my opinion, your job just begins.
Okay. All right. I assume you've seen people plateau before. I mean, it sounds like...
Most of the people that I see end up, they are either plateaued or they'll use something I give them and they'll take it to a really neat level and then they'll level off and they'll plateau because they don't understand that there's no such thing as perpetual motion. Everything has to be sustained. Everything has to be nurtured. Everything has to be nourished. Everything has to be replenished. We have to be replenished. Our minds have to be replenished by sleep. Our minds have to be replenished by nourishment. Business has to be replenished by selling. A lot of the biggest mistake people make, Marty, is they think when they get a relationship or a customer that they have an enfranchised, guaranteed toehold on that person or that distributive source's business forever with no incumbent responsibility on our part for sustaining it and nourishing it and fueling it. But it's like a car. You can put gas in the tank and the car will drive like mad for 287 miles. And when it's gone, if you don't put gas back in it or oil, it isn't going to go any further. It's no different than that in life. It's so logical that people don't think about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the idea of nourishment is almost foreign to most of us.
It is almost foreign, but I mean, if you look at everything as being an organism,
okay.
Or a mechanism.
Okay, and with the...
Okay, if it's electrical, piece of electrical equipment, it has to be nourished electrically. If it's combustion equipment, it has to be nourished through gasoline or through some kind of fuel. If it's a human, got to be nourished through both food and oxygen and rest.
Okay.
If it's an electrum in the body, the mind has to have... water in it. If people who drink too much coffee or alcohol dehydrate their brain, and they don't understand that the brain is, all the wonderment of God notwithstanding, it's a chemical, electrical, it's like a storage battery. It needs to have water. It needs to have conductivity.
Check your fluid levels.
Well, but I mean, maybe I'm making it too medicinalized or too dehumanized, but everything is a process and everything is a mechanism and everything needs to be nourished and re-nourished. And a lot of people delude themselves because they think that you do it once and it's automatic. And if you think about it, I mean, it's like exercise. If you exercise like mad today, let's say that you're in incredible shape and you get your muscles toned, you don't just stop and never do it again, because what happens?
Well,
your body would atrophy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Relationships atrophies. The public's awareness atrophies. Distributive channels atrophy. You got to both keep distributors wanting your product. You got to keep generating and developing demand. I was talking to somebody one time who was high ranking in a consulting capacity for McDonald's, and they said if McDonald's stopped, everyone thinks McDonald's has this great facility. If they stopped advertising for 2 or 3 months, it would only be a matter of time before people would stop going to McDonald's, because you keep their name, you keep provoking them favorably, customers with a specific offer. You got to do that in all your business activities.
Okay. When let's say we take Isaac and he gets this new product out there, doesn't that theoretically give him a base to nourish his clients in another manner? I mean,
sure. The smartest thing to do once you get distribution and customers is to expand and diversify into other products or services up and down the price and the application spectrum. So if you're selling people on a retail level a $600 product through distribution, what you want to do is get those people to, once they're satisfied that you and they love you and they're aggressively selling your products, you want to get the distributors to take on other products or services that either you create or you control. And most people don't understand it. They think in terms of just creation, which is limiting. The most valuable asset you can create is a distribution channel. If you were Isaac and you were successful in this process, you had three channels. You had distributors who were selling it, or manufacturers who were distributing your product to chiropractors and orthopedic surgeons and physical therapists, and you had retail distribution through infomercials, what you'd want to do would be use the distributor channels to put other products or services that either you created or you acquired or you controlled through those, and you want to sell the same products or services directly to your buyers who bought directly from you by infomercial, and you want to also sell them on infomercials. You want to basically optimize what you've invested in. You've invested in your awareness, you've invested in customers, you've invested in distributive channels. And people don't realize those are all assets you've got to take to higher levels. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. The way I get it is I say think nourishment, and then I just think about how other things can grow sideways.
Yes.
These scenarios are so useful. To some Edge listeners, they're going to be able to adapt them almost directly. Even for those of us who can in a given area, we can kind of extrapolate and apply. Why don't we set some of these aside and do them on future Edges? Is that working for you?
You know, I've got. Since I've done hundreds of programs, and since we've invested a non-inconsequential amount of money having this all summarized, and I'm looking at summary outlines that'll refresh my memory of something like 25 very illustrative consultations that I think almost everybody listening to The Edge in business or contemplating going in business or professions could use as springboards of greater distinction, awareness, strategic action. I think it would probably be a great service to them, and I have no problem in subsequent sessions integrating or introducing or reviewing or dealing with one or two more. So sure, no problem.
Okay. In my own private life, and I assume you've seen this in your clients from year to year, we try to follow you in what you teach us, and yet there's also a need for us to generate our own new ideas. Can you tell us how to do that?
Well, what I'd like to do is share with you a couple of really interesting lessons that I've learned. I've spent a lot of time. I think idea generation is one of the keyest areas of wealth building and business distinction and achievement and prosperity available to anybody today. And most people are intimidated, and they find it foreboding, and they think they're incapable of coming up with great ideas. Innovation, ideas, and marketing are the three greatest areas of advantage any business owner or professional or aspiring entrepreneur has to their advantage. I'd like to summarize all. I've studied probably 1,000 people and read probably 100 books, but one particularly impacted me because the guy brought it down to such a low common denominator, and I think I can summarize in probably 5 or 10 minutes a technique and a method for producing ideas that will help anybody. So why don't I give you a little history first?
Yeah,
of all.
Please.
A man that I have the utmost respect for, he's now deceased, named James Webb Young, was the creative director for J. Walter Thompson, which it may still be, the foremost, the largest advertising agency in the world. And back in the 30s and 40s, they were even better at direct response type advertising. Now everything has gotten homogenized and neutered and emasculated, and I'm not sure what they do now. I'm not very, very close to them, but this man was just a genius at idea generation. He got a call from a very good friend of his who was the publisher of a number of magazines, asking him if he would put together a whole process to teach this entire staff of advertising space salesmen and women how to sell ideas. And he was fascinated. James Webb Young was incredulous. He said, well, why would you want that? You're in the magazine business. And the publisher said, because, James, we have one person who is our lead advertising salesman. He outsells all other advertising salespeople combined, and we've studied his techniques. He doesn't sell pages. He doesn't sell space. He doesn't sell our magazine. He sells ideas the advertiser can utilize to make that space work for them. He sells the advertisers transactional ideas. He never sells the intangible things. And it got James Webb Young realizing that selling ideas is the most powerful thing in the world, not selling things. I realized a long time ago, everyone thinks that they need money to grow their business and they want more capital. There's so much capital out there just waiting to be spent, but people don't have a lot of good ideas to spend them behind. And I think the trick here is learning how to come up with ideas. So James Webb Young spent, I don't know, Marty, probably 2 years struggling with this issue of and came up with some really interesting but very, very elegantly simple insights, and I'll share them. First thing he asked, what is an idea? And he used as a reference example the mythical stories that seamen in the South Pacific had for atolls, A-T-O-L-Ls. You know what those are in the coral seas?
Right, little islands.
And they're talking about how a seaman would talk about how he or she would, I guess most of them were he, they would sail by a certain geographical area. There'd be nothing there. They'd come back on the return trip, and then there'd be an island there, and it was bewildering, and they couldn't understand it. And he talked about what it really was. It was basically countless unseen coral workers, you know, constantly constructing one little cell or layer at a time until all of a sudden one day, you know, miraculously a structure appeared. He thought working below the surface, that was pretty well what the mind did in the creating of an idea.
All right.
He realized that the creation of an idea is a process, and as a process, it can be identified and codified. So he gave this formula to people, and I'm going to give it to our listeners, and I should share with you why. Because, first of all, the formula is so simple that to state it, few people who hear it will really believe in it and follow it, which is almost sad but funny. Second, while it is simple to state, it actually requires the hardest kind of intellectual work and discipline to follow, and I'm hoping that the people who have extended themselves and committed themselves to the leap of faith to be listeners, subscribers, devotees to the edge will get the most out of it. So it starts with an understanding of what I'll call the Pareto theory. You know, Pareto is the man that came up with the 80-20 rule. He was a sociologist and a historical scientist in, I think, the 14 or 1600s. And the question is everybody capable of producing good ideas for themselves and others? And the answer to that question is really suggested in the work of Pareto and a book called Mind and Society. Pareto, was a guy that came up with the 80-20 rule. But he thought that the whole world could be divided into two groups, Marty. One he called the speculator, and the other he called the rentier, the R-E-N-T-I-E-R, like renter.
Okay.
The speculator, to Pareto, is the speculative type of person, and is distinguished, according, again, to Pareto, because he constantly, or she constantly, is preoccupied with possibilities of new combinations.
Okay.
Note the word particularly is preoccupied. Pareto described the rentier as the stockholder. These are the people who do routine, unimaginative, conservative people, who the speculator manipulates. And manipulates, he didn't mean in a negative context. He meant in a leverage. So he said there's two kinds of people. There are people who utilize the leverage capability of others, and there are people who basically are content just to basically be followers and reactors. I think the idea generators have got to be what Pareto would call the speculators.